Nation, Manx Radio.
Welcome to the Archive Room podcast. First am I, I'm Judith Lay, and I'm very pleased to find you waiting for me at the door to the Archive Room, the place where we keep stories of island life in years gone by, told by the people who were there. So come on in, sit down and make yourself comfortable, and let's listen to this week's selection. I'm sure you wouldn't expect me to say that I'm in the Archive Room and we're starting with something very topical, but I am. This Saturday evening, it's the hugely popular Braid Ice Deadford, and the literary adjudicator will be the one and only Dot Tilbury. And I'm sure that as she makes all those difficult decisions, she'll be thinking back to her own experiences as a competitor. Whenever Dot takes to the stage, we know we're in for something original, hilarious, and always topical. Here's a young Dot reminding us what happened when Manx Radio started live coverage of the TT races.
I'll tell you a yarn about how it started. My loss, the mind will boggle. Peter Neal's the man that started it all. To his friends he's known as Goggles. Goggles said one day, I've got an idea to broadcast the races, boys. My God, said Jeff Cannell, we'll have to talk loud to compete with the motorbike noise. Shouldn't be difficult for you, said Charlie, with all the shouting in the paper you're doing. Upsetting the big shots that run the show, it's a wonder they're all not suing. Well, the big day arrived and the favourites were racing, but the gremlins had struck once again. The morning took off with mist on the mountain. By 10 it had started to rain. The race was postponed, everyone was informed, but one person they forgot to cater. Ian Cannell was left up the bungalow box. He was still there 2 days later. Well, a fine day arrived and the bike started off and they went down Bray Hill at some speed. Peter Neal said, we'll go to Ballacren now to see who's taking the lead. Peter handed over to Ballacren and we all began to listen. He kept pressing the knob to call Tommy in, but the beggar had gone missing. The race went on and Goggles was desperate. Ballacren's line still was dud. When Tommy arrived in the box at last after staggering out of the pub. There's two bikes pulling into the Ballacrane now. They must be having trouble. But there was only one bike. The Guinness was working. Tommy was seeing double. At Ballagh Bridge, Jeff Cannell was saying his piece about riders who took off in flight. You'll land on your back wheel and not in your front. It's quite easy to get it just right. If I was on me trials bike, he said, I'd land without a quiver. So he tried it one day, the proper way, and landed on his ass in the river. So back to the grandstand. The winner was due. Signpost lights were starting to bleep. But the winner wasn't announced on the wireless at all, because Goggles had fallen asleep. But things have changed since the early days. They've got their stopwatches at last. It was an awful job turning the egg timers over when the riders were all going past. Now Goggles had an alarm clock to keep him awake, and Tommy is off the bottle. Ian's got a survival suit in case of the miss, and Jeff's mouth is not quite full throttle. So the next time you go to the great TT races, or you stay home because of the noise, to get all the news is just switch on your wireless and tune to the Manx Radio boys.
The ageless, talented Dot Tilbury. And the present-day Braid Ice Deadford is this Saturday the 16th, starting at 7:30, and admission is just £5, including a country supper. And remember, you don't have to be a competitor to come to an Ice Deadford. You can just come along and enjoy the entertainment.
The Nation Station, Manx Radio.
And now I'm at the shelf marked Baldwin Valley. And what a wealth of material there is here, thanks to the combined talents of Manx Radio's Charles Webster and lifelong Baldwin resident Tom Cowell. About 32 years ago, Tom wrote a book entitled Baldwin, My Valley, and Charles invited him to turn a lot of material from the book into a series of radio programmes, all recorded walking around the Baldwin area. Let's begin with Tom standing on the embankment, taking us back to the year 1900 and explaining how and why the Baldwin Reservoir came into being.
Well, we're standing on the embankment of West Baldwin today, and I'm looking down the embankment at the remains of the old West Baldwin Road Dingerbreck, which now is buried under the water. As we walk along the embankment, you can hear the water rippling in the large dam just behind us. It was a marvellous achievement, this, and to think that it was all built by pick and shovel.
This must have brought some prosperity to the village, surely.
It did, actually, because the people at that time were very poor, and most of them worked on the farms, and they never got very far. But there was a great upheaval as the people had to move out and find new homes. Quite a lot went down to Laxey, but others stayed and worked on the building of the dam, though they brought in quite a lot of people from Ireland to help out.
When you say people had to move out, where were they then?
When the water at the reservoir is down low, you see lots of little ruins now. Now, these are all little farms and crofts which people lived in, and those people had to move out and go elsewhere to live.
Would they have been compensated in those days?
Very poorly. There's lots of grumbles and complaints at the time. But they got over these things, and because now those people have all died and gone, and it's all forgot about, and they're very thankful to have the extra water, as our population's increased so much these last few years. And as the corporation found that the reservoirs they had in Douglas and up the cliffs were too small, and they couldn't get enough water for the people. So they came out to West Baldwin and discovered that there's a good valley with plenty of water coming in, as it drained of all the mountains round about, Carrigan and Colden and Ingerbreck. The reservoir itself holds 300 million gallons of water, and is 70 feet in depth, 3/4 mile long and 300 yards wide, with a top water area of 60 acres. Now, the engineers at the time was G.H. Hill and Sons. They were engaged as engineering advisors to the corporation, as Douglas Corporation had put it out to contract, but nobody applied to take up the contract. So they went ahead on their own bat. They were very brave men to tackle, because they could easily went wrong and they could have drowned the whole valley. My grandfather, most of his life, had horse and traps, and he used to run around to these different pleasure resorts. And he used to come out to Ingerbreck one, and he met my grandmother then. And when they started work on the Baldwin Reservoir, he applied for a job, and he had the honour of cutting the first sod. So construction was started in October 1900. And to achieve this, they had to lay a railway from St George's Bridge to the site of the dam. And they crossed the river 17 times. Now, this was laid on wooden bridges, and it was all set with a 3-foot gauge track, ready for the opening in January 1901. They had most of the river sheds down in St George's Meadow, as the clay for the dam embankment came from Ballacreach, and the stone for lining the inner wall to keep the water from coming through was brought from Hilbury Quarry.
So what did they actually dig it out with then, Tom?
Oh, well, all they had was machines called steam navvies, and you had your men then with picks and shovels. And the steam navvies took and tore the embankments away and made the trench, and the men used their picks and spades to do the other work.
Where would the men stay who were doing all this work at the time?
Well, most of the men, they had little huts built on the hillside, or they stayed in houses round about. Of course, of an evening, they had no television or entertainment in those days, so they used to wander around the valley, and every house they stayed at had a license to make their own beer, so they had a different brew or different flavour every night to taste. And because of a Sunday then, the churches were too far away in Douglas, because most of them were Irish, and they couldn't go to their church, so they built their own little church on the hillside near Edwallian Farm. Now, that little church is in West Baldwin Village, and it eventually ended up as a young men's reading room. But I remember my father talking about as the mission church at West Baldwin. They had their own resident priest and organist and even a little choir.
So how many men would have been employed here then, Tom?
I've heard my father saying there was 250 men employed there on the dam itself, because on the English side, quite a lot of men came back from the Boer War, and they were unemployed, and they were grateful to have a job to work at.
And I promise you there's lots more to come from Tom Cowell as he tells Charles Webster more about the life and characters of the Baldwin Valley. We're back in the world of education with the colourful teacher and church organist Laurie Davis, born in Wallasey in 1915 and aged 88 when David Collister recorded this conversation with him. Laurie's love affair with the Isle of Man began with many happy childhood holidays in Ramsey, and it was always his dream to be a teacher at Ramsey Grammar School. And he almost made the dream come true when, in 1947, he applied for a job there. But when he attended for interview, he found that what was really needed was someone to teach physics to girls at Park Road School in Douglas, a post he accepted, but with some hesitation, as he explains to David Collister.
So was there something then that was going to make it difficult to teach physics to girls rather than boys?
Well, I think we're going back a long way, you know. We're going back 50 or more years, and girls didn't do many mechanical things apart from the sewing machine.
Right.
And I had to pick my illustrations very carefully that the girls would know what I was talking about. Yes. And incidentally, I had a row with one of the publishing firms who published physics books, and there was no mention at all of girls in them. So we had to use all sorts of domestic illustrations like food mixers and washing machines and the like.
And this would be new to the girls as well, presumably, would it?
Yes, because I was not doing a Manx person out of a job. There'd been the vacancy there for 3 years.
Yes.
So it was a three-year gap to fill up.
This was, of course, at Park Road, wasn't
it? At Park Road. Mm. Though I did eventually go to Ballacameen, which was the junior end of the girls' high school, to teach mathematics. Mm-hmm. And how I came to teach mathematics is an interesting story. The maths department was short of a teacher, and so they advertised for somebody to teach mathematics to O-level. A lady applied, was appointed. She was given a syllabus, and she said, "But I can't teach any of this." She says, "But that's O-level." Well, it seems that she thought that O-level was it was with Hornby and Meccano, where the basic set was O-level. And so the timetables all had to be revised so that I could help the maths department out of the rut into which they'd got themselves. Well, that was all right, because I included a lot of maths in my year's training. I had one or two interesting experiences there. We used to do what were called ruler and compass constructions. Mm-hmm. You could bisect an angle simply using a compass and a straight edge, or you could draw a line perpendicular to another line, and in particular, if you're given a bit of a circle, you could find where the centre was.
Right.
And we'd done this one morning, and I was desperately thinking of some possible application for this, and the only thing that came to my mind was, look, it's your baby brother's birthday tomorrow, he's going to be one. You've made a cake, you want to put a candle in the middle. How would you find the middle? Please, sir, I'd fold it in half. At that point, the door opened and the inspector came in, because we had inspectors with us that day. Another occasion, we had questions where one line depended upon the line before and the rest. And if the whole lot was obviously right, I used to put a big R on it, so it was right. If not, I would go through line by line and tick it until I came to where it broke down.
Right.
Well, I'd handed the books back, and one girl, very indignant, I said, "What's the matter? You've marked mine wrong, but it's the same answer she's got." I said, "Oh, we'll bring it out here." So she brought it out. I said, "Well, there's an R for right." She said, "Well, I thought it was for wrong." She got a degree in English. Hey, you wouldn't believe it. Occasionally, I got a bit mystified. The staff room in Park Road was at the end of a narrow corridor, and I was starting to go down it one day, and the girl stopped me at the end and says, "Are my shoes in the staff room?" Well, I couldn't think of any reason why her shoes should be in the staff room. So what did you say? I said, "My shoes in the staff room." So I went to the staff room, and we got it sorted out. The question was, is Miss used in the staff room. Now, two interesting incidents. Girls who stayed in school for dinner at Park Row were allowed into parts of the building after they had the dinner and before afternoon school started. They were allowed into the hall where there was a mistress on duty, and the other parts were very much restricted. Well, I was going through the school and I came across two girls who were in a place where they shouldn't be. So I said to the first one, "Where are you going?" She says, "I don't know." So I said to the second one, "Where are you going?" "I'm going with her." And then on another occasion, it was a wet afternoon. This was the afternoon break. Mm-hmm. And there were always two prefects on duty to maintain what law and order they could. And I was sort of the backup. And they came to me and said, "I think you better come. There are two girls fighting." I said, "Girls fighting? Never." "Oh, yes." So I went. And there, one girl had got another girl backwards across the desk and was thumping the daylights out of her. So I pulled her off, whereupon she burst into tears. And I got everybody calmed down and said, "Well, now, why were you hitting her?" She said, "Please, sir, I want her to be my friend, and she won't." It came to obvious to me that before very long, I would have to become a form master. And I sort of worked this out. Well, probably the third form, I could do least harm there. But after a couple of years, at the end of the summer term, I was told, "The headmistress wants to see you." "Oh, what have I done?" So I went, and she asked how physics was doing. Well, it was doing very nicely. And she said, "Now I want you to have a form." "Oh, now here we go." "I want you to have the sixth form." "Well, I prefer the word dumbfounded to gobsmacked." But I had no response to that whatsoever. And in September I started with 25 young ladies in my care. Felt like a father trying to get his daughter off the hands because I had to get them into college and university.
Oh, of course, yeah.
We got on very well indeed together. I can remember part of my opening remarks to them. I said, "Look now, a lot of the people you were with in the fifth form and have left school, they're in offices, shops, training in hospitals and the like. They're young ladies." Mm. I said, "As far as I'm concerned, you're in the same category as they are. I propose treating you as young ladies."
Right.
"Which in return, I want you to behave such."
Yes. But that got you off to a good start, did it?
It did indeed, yes.
Any other incidents from this time at Park Road?
Oh, well, there was one. We used to do practical physics. The girls used to work in pairs. And one afternoon, I think it was the fifth form were coming, they arrived, and I said, "Well, now, where's Anne?" "Oh, she's coming." "Oh, all right." So started the lesson, gave them back their homework, went over it with them, then told them the experiment we were going to do, what we were looking for and all the rest of it, gave out the apparatus. Still no Anne. I said, "Well, where's Anne? Where's she got to?" "Oh, sir, she's taken the mother to the vet. They're having the cat doctored." Well, how I went on with the lesson at that point, I do not know.
So quite happy times, really. Yeah.
They were very happy times indeed.
At this time, then, were teachers wearing their mortarboards and their cloaks?
Oh, heavens, no.
No.
Not at all when I was there. What they were doing at the boys' school, I'm not too sure.
They did a bit of that at the boys' school,
I believe so, yes. But,
and what about the dress of the pupils? A uniform? Had to be uniform?
Oh, yeah, proper uniform, yes. Navy blue skirt, white blouse, tie, and from Miss Naylor, no coloured hair slides. No jewellery on your fingers.
Mm-hmm.
But after few years, the dress was almost an undress. We'd reached the time of the miniskirt, which were more of a pelmet than anything else. And winter was coming on, and my girl said to me, "Would you ask the headmistress if we can wear trousers or slacks or what have you?" And I said, "Well, I'll do that, yes. But why don't you wear longer skirts?" They said, "Oh, we couldn't do that. It's not fashionable." So apparently you'd rather freeze than be unfashionable.
What about hairstyles? I mean, you referred to slides, but
yes,
there was in the 60s there was this bouffant hairstyle and so on. Were there any rules on girls' hair?
Well, I made a rule for my own form, I said, which was the sixth form, that before any girl changed her hairstyle, I wanted 48 hours' notice. And if she was going to change its colour, I wanted 60 hours' notice.
Why did you make that rule? Were you joking or what?
Well, I was joking, yes. Well, one would appear and you didn't recognise her the next day. She turned out to be a ravishing blonde. Oh, one interesting little item. The physics lab was, along with the other science labs, in the building on its own, a very short few paces from the main building. There were two steps up to the labs and about six steps down from the main building.
Mm.
And I'd finished a lesson just before break. I was going out at break, and girls were coming over from the other side, some running rather quickly. And as I got to the top of the steps on my side, another girl also got to the top of the steps.
Mm.
And being a very polite girl, well, I taught her mother, so she would be polite, she stepped backwards, and in so doing began to fall backwards.
Yes.
Well, being the perfect gentleman, I clasped her to me. Nice-looking girl, too. And the other girls sort of stood in amazement seeing their physics master hugging one of their own girls.
You'd be getting yourself in the tabloids these days if you did that, wouldn't you?
I almost did, because we had the A-level exams, which are very important, and one girl got her time wrong. She should have been there for 9 o'clock on Monday morning, but she didn't turn up. So I got in touch with her mother. She said, oh, with the exams this afternoon. Well, I said, that's what you may think, but what we think in the hall is this morning. She said, get her in as fast as you can.
Yeah.
So she came in a very excited state, and I said, look, love, you've got plenty of time to answer all the questions and do all right, so don't panic, just get on and answer, which she did, and she passed. Well, years later, somebody showed me the opening page of a ladies' magazine where the readers sent in a letter and got £2 or whatever it was for it. And there was an account of this and how kind Mr. Davis had been to her.
Right.
Yes. Oh, so I did get into the magazine.
Yes. The sound of your life.
Manx Radio. And there are still more stories to come from teacher and church organist Laurie Davis. Carol singing and dealing with a suspected bomb are still on the shelf in the archive room. The celebration of an anniversary at Moran School was a chance for David Collister to meet up with some former students and teachers too. Here, David talks with Mrs. Annie McCard, who clearly believed in the importance of passing on life skills to her pupils.
Now, when did you actually start at Moran School? Can you remember?
I was in Liverpool first. 1927 it must have been.
How long were you there?
About till 1934 I got married.
What were youngsters like in those days? I mean, well, you didn't have the discipline.
Well, they're not much discipline. That's what I had to try and do, bring a bit of discipline to their lives. They were used to walking around the classroom and do what they like. Get back to your seat, please. I have never seen children walking around ad lib like this.
So did you control them?
I had to control them, yes.
Yeah.
And they liked it. They didn't mind. I got on well with them.
Table manners worried you as well, didn't they?
Oh, the table manners were terrible. I used to go in when they were having their meal in my room, you see, and they'd be like a cow drink.
Give us an example. Do that with your tea. You've got it here now. What did they do? Were they as bad as that?
Much
worse than that. Worse
so
than
how
that.
How did you settle that one?
Well, I said, put your cups down. Now then, come on, Robert, let me see you take a drink. So I took a drink and held it up to my mouth by the handle. That's what the handle is for, lift it up. And you know, they got accustomed to doing that, and that was made right. Then on Friday afternoon, made them into groups of four, and some of them brought biscuits, you see, and some little cakes or scones, and I brought some. And we had a little tea party. Made them into groups of four. Lots of little tea parties. Now, I said, if your neighbour hasn't anything to eat, pass something to her. Don't just dive in yourself.
So that's how they learned to sit at the table properly.
Yes, they did. And another thing, they had to come across the fields in winter, ploughed fields, to get to school, and their feet were covered in mud. I said, we can't have this, you know. But well, they thought that was just the thing to do. So I said, no, just stand here. I sent them out into the porch, two at a time, and if they weren't done properly, back again. And eventually we got all their shoes clean. Then their mouth covered with jam from breakfast. They hadn't washed themselves. Oh, good gracious, let me see. Oh, you're all sticky. And then you're handling books with your sticky fingers. Go and wash your hands and wash your mouth.
Mrs. Annie McCard, teacher at Moran School between the two wars, and it was in Moran that David Collister met possibly his oldest interviewee, Hayward Gelling, who went to school in 1897, the year of Queen Victoria's Diamond Jubilee, and could still recite poems he'd learned in the classroom. But Hayward will have to feature in another visit to the archive room, because that's all we have time for this week. Next week, we'll be on the Calf of Man, in the Baldwin Valley again, and meeting a couple of Douglas butties, and that's got nothing to do with a lunchtime snack. But for now, let's turn off the lights and close the door. Don't forget, you can find this and all the programmes in the previous series of The Archive Room by subscribing for free to The Archive Room podcast at manxradio.com or via your usual podcast provider. I'm Judith Lay, saying thank you for listening and wishing you a very good evening.
The Nation Station, Manx Radio.